What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning on Two Jewish are Laura Adkins and Aiden Pink, the young editors at The Forward of the Jewish Guide to College. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mavena on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our new Shinchinim, Chen Denachi, and Tamir Shakuri, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2Jewish.
Shalom. There was a lot of attention paid last week to the solar eclipse, in case you didn't notice. All this focus on the burning ball of gas in the sky was no doubt appropriate. The sun doesn't disappear mid-morning every day. In fact, the next eclipse to go over so much of America won't occur for about 100 years.
There's nothing I can do, a total eclipse of the heart.
The sight of so many people wearing dark, special eclipse glasses, all staring at the sky, was fascinating. The pictures reminded me of those photos from the 1950s of people in theaters watching movies with 3D glasses on, although this happened in 2017. The extravaganza of solar attention was inspired by scientific observation, of course, but in truth, the sun has always been a focus of religious attention throughout human existence. Most of the sacred places on the planet are oriented in one way or another towards the sun. You can see this from Stonehenge in England to Karnak Temple in Luxor, Egypt, to Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, to Bodh Gaya, India, to Angkor Wat, Cambodia, to Kyoto, Japan, to Machu Picchu, Peru, to Teotihuacan in Mexico, and, well, many more places around the world and throughout human history. Right up to today, most holy places face the great daylight source in the sky, and most calendars were and are focused on the sun as well. Ancient religions worship the sun in one way or another, but not Jews. And the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, when it stood, wasn't oriented towards the sun either. Neither are Jewish synagogues today. Even the Jewish calendar isn't based on the sun. Instead, Judaism is focused on God as the eternal presence found everywhere, not tied to one celestial body or aspect of creation. Instead, God is the source of creation. Tradition does teach God is more intensely sensed in Israel, where we first explored God's meaning in our lives and our world. But for Jews, God isn't local, but universal. And the Jewish calendar has always been regulated by the cycles of the moon. You know, that object that got between us and the sun last week, causing those minutes of daytime darkness that got everybody so excited. Well, we are now in the early days of the Jewish calendar, month of Elul, the final month of the year when we begin to prepare ourselves for the coming Jewish days of awe, the High Holy Days, about 3.5 weeks from now, with Rosh Hashanah beginning Wednesday night, September 20th. It is the moon that determines our calendar. Well, we are now in the early days of the Jewish calendar, month of Elul, last month of the year when we begin to prepare ourselves for the coming Jewish days of awe, the High Holy Days, about 3.5 weeks from now, with Rosh Hashanah beginning Wednesday night, September 20th. To remind us that Teshuvah, repentance and return, are more than a two-day-a-year process, we Jews sound the shofar each day of the month of Elul, awakening us to the need to reform and return to the best that we can be, to apologize to those we have wronged or injured. Blowing shofar is a great way to wake everybody up. A shofar is a ram's horn hollowed out, and hearing it is a wonderful way to experience the urgency of the coming High Holy Days, an ancient, haunting sound, beautiful and dramatic. I brought my shofar along this morning to blow us into 2Jewish today. And now to play us in this morning, more elegantly on the same theme of the shofar, we begin with a setting of the classic Rosh Hashanah text, Tka B'Shofar. Sound the great shofar of freedom, proclaiming liberty, gathering our exiles from the four corners of the earth to return, even to return to temple for services on Rosh Hashanah.
Tka, Tka B'Shofar Gadol L'Chirutenu, Mesales, Mesales L'Kades Galuyotenu, Bekamtenu Yahad Me'era, Me'era, Me'ar Bakan Kotaret, Me'ar Tzenu.
Tka, Shofar gadol lecheirutenu v'sa v'sanes v'sanes lekabet galuyotenu v'kabetzeinu yachad mehera mehera
me'ar bakan fotaret v'yatzeinu Tka
Kabetzeinu yachad mehera mehera
me'ar bakan fotaret me'yatzeinu Tka Tka
Tka b'shofar gadol
Tka b'shofar gadol
Tka
b'shofar gadol
Tka b'shofar gadol Tka b'shofar gadol
Tka b'shofar
That was Tka B'Shofar for the coming High Holy Days, the season of the shofar. Our guests this morning, Laura Adkins and Aidan Pink, the forward editors of the Jewish Guide to Colleges, have done a wonderful job exploring and selecting the very best colleges for Jewish students. Find out which ones they are and how they decided that when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Are you curious? Well, now we have everything you wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Temple Emanuel's famous Taste of Judaism program, now in its 18th year, offers an exploration of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community, taught by our rabbis. This free introductory class is immensely popular in southern Arizona. 6,000 students have enjoyed Taste to date, and you can too. Call 327-4501 for more information and register today. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity to learn more about Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. Rediscover your roots or simply satisfy your curiosity about Judaism. Classes are free and open to all, and we feed you too. We have daytime and evening classes in Central and Northwest Tucson, and this year also in Green Valley. Taste of Judaism starts soon, so don't miss it. Again, it's free with no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Temple Emanuel at 327-4501 or email temple@tetucson.org. Call 520-327-4501 for a fun way to learn about Judaism.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through 8th grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, THAAZ.org, 529-3888.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning, Aidan Pink and Laura Adkin, who are co-editors of the new Forward Jewish Guide to Colleges, I guess is the best way to put it. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning.
So I guess the Shehechianu is in order. This is the first time the Forward has published something like this. Tell us how it happened.
Yeah, we're very excited. Both Aidan and I are recent graduates.
And you have to say
a little more recently.
You have to say where your graduate's from. It's like a law.
Yes, so I graduated from NYU, so go Violets/Bobcats, depending on the day.
And I graduated from American University in Washington, D.C., which is one of the top 10 schools in the country if you rank them alphabetically.
Mazel tov.
Yeah, so we're actually both Midwesterners, so it's a little...
Oh, and by the way, NYU is one of the top 10 schools in the country if you rank them by how much they cost. my daughter's
yes,
looking at schools now, so I know this. Okay, so go ahead, tell us how this happened.
Sure. So we both were very interested in creating something useful for both parents and prospective students when looking for colleges, but also we didn't want to focus on kind of the fear-mongering that often happens when people talk about campus life. So we included things that are, you know, scary, like anti-Semitism and BDS. And Aidan can tell you a little bit more about his end of things, but we really wanted to focus on highlighting the awesome stuff going on around the country.
Yeah, my younger brother, who was a high school senior when we began the project, he's now just moved in for his freshman year of college, and I remember having talked to him and having gone through that college application process not so long ago. It was difficult to find a lot of information about Jewish life on campus without directly going to the Hillel or Chabad, but they didn't have all the information that maybe one would want. So I thought it would be helpful for, you know, my family's sake and hopefully for lots of other Jewish families' sake to have a go-to resource that provides as much information as possible about anything that is possibly of concern or interest to Jewish students and parents, and we hope that the guide provides that.
So most Jewish parents, as we head for it, and I'm not sure how many college students are reading the guide, but I guarantee you a lot of Jewish parents are. Most of us start out by knowing a little bit about a school and thinking, oh, we'll check Hillel and, you know, we'll see if there's a Chabad house. And that's pretty much as far as we go. What was the most surprising thing you found when you started doing this?
I mean, there were definitely a lot of surprising things and inspiring things. I think to me the most surprising and exciting part was just how diverse Jewish life and Jewish activities are around the country. It's, you know, we have campuses all across the country and all doing cool things like building Mars rovers and, you know, having a Scooby-Jew club. And every single Hillel and Chabad director and OUJLIC couple we talked to was just so excited to tell us about all the diverse things happening at their campus.
I think also it was exciting and nice to reaffirm that there are a lot of great universities that provide, you know, a plethora of fantastic Jewish opportunities. I think sometimes it's easy to be a bit reductive and say, oh, there are like 10 or 15 schools that are good for Jews. But every single school on our list of 171 universities is a great school for Jewish students. And, you know, some of them do provide more opportunities than others. But what I think we show if you go through all of the entries and all of our ranked lists and sublists is that there are so many things you can do at schools literally all over the continental United States.
We will hear much more about Jewish life on college campuses from Aidan Pink and Laura Adkin, the Forward editors of the very first Forward Jewish Guide to Colleges, when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish. You work hard every day, and that's why the Tucson Jay wants to celebrate you at their Labor Day Bash on September 4th. From 11 to 3, bring the family and save hundreds with their one-day membership sale. And the first 50 people get a free week of membership in the Jay. With more than 110 fitness classes weekly, early childhood education, after-school care, art and culture classes, when you join the Tucson Jay, you're joining more than just a gym. You're joining a community. So don't miss a chance to save hundreds at the Tucson Jay Labor Day Bash September 4th. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you led, I guess, kind of a revolutionary trip a long time ago, and now you're going to do a reunion of it, and it's important for the Jewish community of America and Israel to a degree. Tell us about it.
Okay. You've opened a rich load of gold here. Back in 1973, when I was but a lad, the summer that I was going to be on staff for the Ramah Israel Seminar, the campers who were going from Camp Ramah in Wisconsin, with whom I had worked for like five summers in a row, nagged us relentlessly for at least a year before that summer to take them to the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe on the way, because they had heard stories from me of my first visit to that part of the world, which back in those days was the height of the Cold War. It was Brezhnev. It was the Iron Curtain. It was a deep, dark place, barely letting Jews out to make Aliyah to Israel. They had a very different emigration policy then from what they do now, and that was an example of how U.S. diplomacy, working together with the legislative branch, actually affected Soviet foreign policy. In any case, my buddy, who was the head of sports programming at Camp Ramah, Wisconsin, and I, barely out of our teens ourselves, took this group of kids who were between 11th and 12th grade. So they were like 16, 17 years old. And the first summer we did it on a bus that picked us up at the Brussels airport, went eventually all the way to Moscow with lots of stops.
On the bus.
On the bus.
Wow.
Then we gave the bus driver and the bus a rest. We took a fast train up to St. Petersburg, back to Moscow, reconnected with the bus, and went back to Brussels by a different route, obviously crossing Ukraine, Belarus, Poland, Germany. We stopped at the time in both West and East Berlin. Germany was still divided. It was a very different world.
Right.
And there were 30 kids. Of those kids, at least half were from the two congregations that my friend and I grew up in, which is Bethel in Highland Park, Illinois, and B'nai Emunah in St. Louis. And the other half were miscellaneous kids whose parents had known us for many years. Otherwise, why would they trust 21-year-olds to take their 16-year-olds to some odd part of the country? We had almost no institutional backing. At Camp Ramah in Wisconsin didn't oppose it. The national level said, okay, maybe, and we sort of bargained a little, and I ended up inviting the wife of the National Ramah director back in the day to come with us as a bona fide adult, well into her 40s with kids of her own. Turned out that wasn't really necessary, except that her testimony as to how wildly successful this trip was ensured that the following summer it would be an official Ramah program. It doubled in size. It took kids from all the Ramah camps. And to put it mildly, this trip was a turning point in the lives of these young people. Of our original group of 30, eight subsequently made Aliyah and have spent the rest of their lives in Israel,
wow,
which is an amazing percentage.
An incredible percentage.
And many of those original 30 regard the trip as like the key event in their lives. And so we're about to do a kind of reunion, which I guess I'll tell you about next week.
Well, and I should also note that this is the first of the trips that have led to a whole series of programs, March of the Living, among them, in which teens go to Eastern Europe before going on Israel. And we'll talk about that, and you can talk about the reunion next week. Thanks,
Tom. I look
Tom.
Forward to it.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish, for the very first time, Chen Dinachi and Tamir Shikori. They are the new Shin Shinim, replacing, as our two Jewish listeners know, Leah Avuno and the Bar El-Kahar, who served their year of service for Israel here on Two Jewish over the last year. Welcome, Bruchim Habaim. Welcome to America, and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
So, why don't you introduce yourselves? Tell us a little bit about what the Shnat Sherut, the year of service, that you're both 18 years old, you just graduated from high school, and you're here representing Israel. Tamir, let's start with you.
So, hi, I'm Tamir. I'm 18 years old. I live in a small moshav. And Chen and I are here to volunteer in the Jewish community in Tucson. And we're very excited to be here. After a long screening process, we got accepted to this amazing program through the Jewish Agency. And we're here to be volunteering in several synagogues and the JCC and schools. And we're really happy to be here. And we hope that we'll bring Jewish students closer to Israel and show them what we think it is.
So tell us what a moshav is, because a lot of people in America don't, they may have heard the term kibbutz and have some vague idea of that. I'm sure they don't know what a moshav is, most people.
So a moshav is a really small village. Actually, my village has only about 800 people, and I know most of them, and we go to school together, most of the kids my age, and we have holidays together and ceremonies, and it's a really nice place where you can really walk down the street and know everyone, and there's a really nice atmosphere. And
so it's kind of like a kibbutz in that people know each other. It's small. You work together. Maybe you're raised together. But you have some private property, too.
Yes, you have some private property. And also, most of the people are working with agricultural like lands. And that's the special thing about a moshav in comparison to the kibbutz.
Chen, tell us about your background. You're from a very different background, actually.
Yeah, I'm actually from a small town right near Tel Aviv in the center of Israel.
Right near the airport, right?
Right near the airport.
And it's called Shoham?
It's called Shoham. It's a great place. It has 20,000 people, although it still feels very homey, kind of like Tucson, which is big but homey. And I really like it. It's a great place to grow up in. Besides that, I love my friends. I've been with all of my friends since I was 3 years old, and it's something really, really special. And
so this is quite a difference, right? Leaving all of your friends, or Tamir, leaving a town where you know everybody and coming to a place where you really don't know anybody. You're doing it to represent Israel and just be examples of what Israel's like. How's that feel?
Well, I feel like I was expecting to feel a lot more lonely, but people here are so warm and so welcoming. And
that's not just because it's 100 degrees outside.
No, the people are great and wonderful, and no one lets us feel alone, and the host families are amazing. I'm staying currently with really nice people, and everything has been amazing so far, and the workplaces are very understanding and very supportive. Everyone really tries to make us feel at home, and it works. I do not feel lonely whatsoever. I feel like I came to a home from away from home.
Well, we're delighted, and we look forward to hearing about your lives in Israel and your experiences of what's different here in America and Israel over the course of the year. Welcome again.
Thank you.
We'll talk next week. We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Good morning. Boker Tov.
You know, we started talking last week about how Jewish education can instill values teach values, explore values in a meaningful way.
Right.
You taught in a secular setting.
Yes. Yeah, I taught 11 years in the classroom.
And they told you, don't teach values, teach curriculum, right?
Yeah, and you know, the early induction as a teacher to a large public school system, which shall be nameless, the message was, don't teach values. And I think, you know, the political climate in America had been shifting, and there was sensitivity to those kinds of things. But you know, how can you be a teacher and not share your values? When we hire teachers, we hire people who we believe have integrity, good moral character, and of course, that's all about values. So,
we're putting our kids in their hands, and I mean, they're spending more time with their teachers than they are with their parents.
Absolutely, and the trust there is enormous. And I felt, you know, okay, I'm not gonna convert people to my political beliefs or, you know, make hardcore believers of John Ben Asher's values, nothing like that. But I certainly felt it was important to share some values like caring about other people, trying to make the world a better place, having goals and a vision and working towards your goals in a way that wasn't harmful to others. And when you're teaching literature and you're teaching history and social studies, that kind of content is very, very values laden. And I always felt, you know, it's my job to be balanced. And so I would share, this is my opinion, and that's just one person. You have your own opinion. And as you're growing up, it's important to honor that and listen to yourself and develop your thoughts with good information from all sides.
And talk to your parents.
And talk to your parents, that's right. And there are other opinions. And your family has its own opinions and values. So you can approach it in a way that's balanced. But I think to say that you can't teach values is really misplaced. And certainly in a Jewish educational setting, we're all about values. We don't shy away from that. That's a core component of what we do in this work.
You know, I was thinking, how do you teach history or Shakespeare mm-hmm. without exploring the values that are clearly...
Absolutely.
Sometimes explicitly explored in these events and these
You know, and that's a neat thing about a Jewish day school environment, because you can get your Shakespearean lens and your historical lens and then your Talmudic lens and the stories from the Torah, and you get this really interesting... global set of approaches to learning about what we value in life.
A really rich environment to explore how we choose to live.
Yeah.
Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Have a great day.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A priest and rabbi sit next to each other on a plane. After a while, the priest turns to the rabbi and asks, "Is it still a requirement of your faith to not eat pork?" The rabbi responds, "Yes, that's still one of our beliefs." The priest asks, "Have you ever eaten pork?" The rabbi replies, "Yes, once I did succumb to temptation and tasted a ham sandwich." The priest nods in understanding and goes on reading. A little later, the rabbi speaks up and asks the priest, "Father, is it still a requirement of your church that you remain celibate?" The priest replies, "Yes, that is still very much part of our faith." The rabbi asks, "Father, have you ever fallen to the temptations of the flesh?" The priest replies, "Yes, Rabbi, on one occasion I was weak and broke with my faith." The rabbi nods understandingly. He's quiet for a bit, and then he turns and says, "Beats a ham sandwich, doesn't it?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. A question. What are the most important laws of all? Our weekly portion of Ki Teitse in Deuteronomy obligates us to ask, for it is filled with an array of laws and ordinances affecting every aspect of life. They range from rules limiting unorthodox ritual practice to rules limiting conduct in wartime, from personal morality to behavior in society. Family laws are established concerning marriage, inheritance, and divorce. Tort laws on damages are instituted, providing moral and financial responsibility for property owners. Laws of kindness decree human decency in every area of life. Lots and lots of laws, laws, laws. Some obscure, some famous. In short, Ki Teitse is a bit dry. There's a reason law books have never made the New York Times bestseller list. And much of the legislation in Ki Teitse is outdated. Other sections are completely irrelevant today. But two sets of related laws established in Ki Teitse guarantee its place in the highest of moral realms. Both put into practical terms what the Torah has already stressed. When a person is in your power economically, you must not exploit his weakness. The first of these laws states that if you take as pledge an item of clothing from a poor person, you must return it to him before nightfall. You must not allow an impoverished man or woman to spend the night without proper clothing or shelter. This is a necessary reminder for our society, which tolerates homelessness in a manner that the much poorer world of the time of the Torah would not. It is simply not Jewishly acceptable to blatantly disregard human misery. The second law states unequivocally and memorably that you must pay a worker on the day he completes his labor. In our society, delays of 2 or more weeks are common for payroll, even for minimum wage employees who need the money the most. Money is often withheld from workers who have earned it to pay for anticipated taxes, health care needs, and other deductions. This would never fly in the Torah or the Talmud, which at the least implies God's disapproval for such practices. Created over 2,500 years ago, the Torah insists on a higher standard of morality for employers than we do today. As Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president, said, labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves the higher consideration. Labor has innate value, and honest work deserves immediate pay. It's a simple lesson, and one we still haven't quite learned in 2017. Perhaps it's time to allow Ki Teitse to teach us that once again. When we return on To Jewish, our guests, Aidan Pink and Laura Adkins, co-editors for the foreword of the New Jewish Guide to College, will tell us what was most surprising about their research into schools and their Jewish experiences. Find that out and much more when we return in a moment here on To Jewish. You work hard every day, and that's why the Tucson Jay wants to celebrate you at their Labor Day Bash on September 4th. From 11 to 3, bring the family and save hundreds with their one-day membership sale. And the first 50 people get a free week of membership in the Jay. With more than 110 fitness classes weekly, early childhood education, after-school care, art and culture classes, when you join the Tucson Jay, you're joining more than just a gym. You're joining a community. So don't miss a chance to save hundreds at the Tucson Jay Labor Day Bash September 4th.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu,
Comedian, movie star, recording artist, director, producer, screenwriter, and muscular dystrophy telethon hero Jerry Lewis died last week. He was 91 years old.
Navy service is ideal. Printed menus every meal. And they decorate your plate with parsley green. In the Army, we get chow that you wouldn't feed a child. Oh, the Navy gets the gravy, but the Army gets the beans.
Beautiful beans, gorgeous beans, succulent beans.
And the bologna, cause I'm skinny and bony. Yes, the Navy gets the gravy, but the Army gets the
beans, 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 beans.
Born in Newark, New Jersey, grandson of a rabbi, Joseph Levitch was always the class clown, wild in his efforts to get a laugh. He was never much of a student, had to repeat the sixth grade. His father, a minor entertainer, used the stage name of Danny Lewis, so when his son began performing, he became Jerry Lewis. Lewis was expelled from high school in 10th grade after punching the principal, who called him a dumb Jew. He worked odd jobs, including as a busboy, sometimes appearing with his father in the Catskills. At the age of 16, he started doing stand-up comedy. His first shtick was wild lip-syncing to popular songs of the time in burlesque clubs. Soon he was doing stand-up comedy every night, one club or another. When Jerry Lewis was 20 years old, he got a casual friend, Dean Martin, then 29, a mildly successful singer, got him a job as the singer in a nightclub show in which Lewis was the comedian. Lewis started mugging behind Martin's singing. Soon their act was wildly popular, and they quickly rose to the top of the club circuit in New York. They actually didn't have a gag writer at first, because Jerry Lewis would improvise ridiculous shtick with the best of them, and the way the two of them enjoyed each other on stage came out in the act. They soon rose to the pinnacle of the entertainment world. From 1946 to 1956, Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin were the top comedy act in the world, with hugely successful films, TV series and specials, and live shows that were wildly popular. Martin was the handsome straight man and crooner, and Lewis was the slapstick, manic, nine-year-old man-child, the comedic talent, who also sang a bit. While their films cannot be described as artistic classics, they have held up pretty well, mostly because of Lewis's manic talents. Martin was smooth and suave, and Lewis was, well, the monkey boy.
Okay.
Jerry Lewis was also a very smart man and a businessman. He studied filmmaking, turned himself into a director and producer. The comedy partnership with Dean Martin eventually collapsed. In 1956, Martin and Lewis broke up their duo. They did not meet again for 20 years. Lewis wasn't sure he could be a successful solo act, but he filled in for Judy Garland one night when she had laryngitis doing a nightclub show in Las Vegas. That led to Jerry Lewis recording a cover of Al Jolson's Rockabye that sold 7 million copies. He went on to make a series of very commercially successful films on his own, including semi-classics like The Nutty Professor and The Bellboy. Jerry Lewis pioneered the use of instant videotape on movie sets so he could direct himself. He developed sets and soundstage innovations that were revolutionary, and in 1960, he signed the biggest contract in motion picture history to that time. His film career ran through the 60s until his style of comedy and the fact that he was now a middle-aged man acting like a nine-year-old simply wore out. Lewis was a workaholic. He made 33 movies in 16 years at Paramount Pictures. He survived a heart attack on the set, coming back to work 10 days later. Jerry Lewis was as serious about his work as he was nuts on screen in some 50 films. By 1971, Lewis was out of the motion picture business. His health began to fail in large part because of the many pratfalls he had taken for laughs and the pain pills he was taking. From 1981 on, Lewis had some roles on screen. He was always wildly popular in France, however. They never lost their love for his work. He is considered a genius there.
Do we not have it right, or was that it? Yeah, try a little here for
yours us. Yours is very goyish. You have to have a little Semitic to it, like, Wolladen!
In 1952, he started doing fundraising for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. Jerry Lewis's annual Labor Day telethons raised ultimately billions of dollars to combat the dread disease. Martin and Lewis reunited on stage just once in 1976 at Lewis's Muscular Dystrophy Association telethon. Their mutual pal Frank Sinatra brokered the meeting. Jerry Lewis continued to host the Muscular Dystrophy Telethon until 2010 at the age of 84. Jerry Lewis' on-screen persona was a cross between Menashe Skolnick, the great Yiddish theater crazy comic, Robin Williams, and a Jewish Jim Carrey with more nebbish mixed in. He was one of a kind.
That's why I'm keeping the faith. Yeah, 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 keeping the faith.
Last week, in performance, Billy Joel wore a yellow Star of David on his sports coat during the encore at his monthly concert at Madison Square Garden in response to the recent surge of anti-Semitism in America. Photos of the legendary singer-songwriter wearing the star appeared on Facebook shortly after his performance last Monday night. One tweet bore the hashtag Charlottesville. Other people called Joel a true hero, his decision to wear the star epic and brave. One tweet read, "So dope seeing Billy Joel live and take a stand to the hate in our country. Wearing the Star of David is a huge statement." Both of Billy Joel's parents are Jewish. His father was among the troops that liberated a concentration camp. He's descended from German Jews, but he wasn't brought up with much practice. But Joel is proud of being a cultural Jew and now for standing up against anti-Semitism in this powerfully symbolic way. Billy Joel issued a statement later in reaction to all the attention his gesture received, using the famous quote from Edmund Burke, "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing."
There's nothing I can do, a total eclipse of the heart.
There were many upbeat stories about the eclipse last week, but there were also, well, some problems. In Oregon, anti-Semitic banners were hung on two northbound interstate highways last Sunday, a week ago today, on a road heavily traveled by California tourists going to get a better view of the solar eclipse. The banners read, "Un-Jew Humanity, Eclipse Whitey, Jewish Financing Available, and Resist Racial Eclipse." The banners were taken down later in the day. Neo-Nazi Jimmy Marr of Springfield, Oregon, whose Twitter handle is Genocide Jimmy, took responsibility for the banners that night on social media. Beth Dershowitz of Sacramento said, "I cannot believe we still have to face this vicious anti-Semitism in such a public place in 2017. We want to expose this hatred so people stop pretending like it isn't happening in our own backyards." In June, a sign blaming Jews for the 9/11 attacks was hung from a pedestrian bridge over an interstate highway in Portland. And the annual Rabbis High Holy Days conference call with the President of the United States has been canceled by the rabbis' organizations. Each year of Barack Obama's presidency, U.S. rabbis organized a call to speak with the president ahead of the Jewish High Holy Days. I had the privilege of participating in a few of those over the last 8 years, but this year, citing President Trump's lack of leadership after Charlottesville, rabbinical groups representing the Reform, Reconstructionist, and Conservative movement issued a joint statement announcing their decision. The president's words have given succor to those who advocate anti-Semitism, racism, and xenophobia, they said. Responsibility for the violence that occurred in Charlottesville, including the death of Heather Heyer, does not lie with many sides, but with one side: the Nazis, alt-right, and white supremacists who brought their hate to a peaceful community. They must be roundly condemned at all levels. Orthodox rabbinical organizations have not yet said whether they will organize a separate phone call with the president, but they have issued their own condemnations of his response to Charlottesville. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guests this morning, Aidan Pink and Laura Adkin. They're the co-editors of the brand new, very first Forward Jewish Guide to Colleges. We started speaking earlier in the show about how this guide came about. This is a really nasty question. What was your favorite Jewish college? I mean, you had to pick kind of in the top. Like, how did you come to that determination, and did you argue about it?
Well, the nice thing about this project was that obviously we feel very strongly about our alma maters and the Midwest and all things we have a connection to, but our formula was blind to all of that. We didn't start calculating the rankings until we'd already figured out all of the different 55 variables that we wanted to plug in the formula. So it was a really exciting moment a couple weeks before launch when we, you know, hit the sort button and were surprised and excited about seeing all of the schools in the order that they were. Me being from Missouri, I was excited that Washington University in St. Louis was ranked pretty highly, but I think it was just exciting to see, you know, non-East Coast schools, two of the top five are non-Northeastern schools, both Emory University and Washington University.
With Vanderbilt trailing very close behind.
Right. Actually, I think they were number five, so three of the top five were not Northeastern traditional schools you associate with the large Jewish communities. So that was really affirming to know that there's not just one flavor of Jewish life, and there's not just one campus providing diverse Jewish life.
In the interest of full disclosure, I have to tell you, my son is a senior at Vanderbilt, and my cousin graduated from Vanderbilt, is now in rabbinical school. So I feel somehow affirmed, maybe because I write checks there. Was there a regional difference? You mentioned that obviously in the Northeast, we tend to think about them as better places or more typical places for Jewish kids to go. Were there regional differences in the quality or level of Jewish life and the kind of resistance that students experience, either through BDS or other kinds of problems?
I think speaking generally, when it comes to the West Coast, it's fair to say that BDS is more active than other regions of the country. But if you go to schools in the University of California system and, you know, Arizona, Oregon, Washington State, they also have thriving Jewish life. I think if you're going to split it regionally, the types of schools that are available to you differ geographically by region across the country. Growing up in the Midwest, you know, what's typical for me and a lot of my friends growing up was the Big Ten school with 50,000 students, you know, many Jews, and sort of get that sort of traditional college atmosphere. If you go in New England, a lot more of them are smaller liberal arts colleges. So that affects the type of student who'd be interested in those universities in the first place, as well as the type of Jewish activities that are provided there. But I think overall, there's a nice geographic distribution among the great schools across the entire country.
I think another really important thing to remember is, you know, number one, yes, of course, New York, California, big cities that traditionally have a lot of Jewish infrastructure are going to attract a lot of Jewish students just by virtue of the access to synagogues they have, the access to kosher food, the access to Jewish institutions. But a ton of campuses on our list have only a few hundred Jewish students or fewer, and they still have really innovative, really interesting, really high-quality Jewish life. So it's not just these bubbles of Jewish enclaves that have great things going on for Jewish students.
How did you assess the level of, I mean, there's obviously lots of wonderful Jewish experiences possible. How do you measure the stress of either anti-Semitic incidents or which are not always reported? For example, I was looking at the University of Arizona, which I know well, of course, being in Tucson. And I know there were some anti-Semitic things that took place, you know, they just probably didn't end up being reported. How do you assess the pressure or the level of BDS activity, whether that affects Jewish life? Like, how did you measure that?
Yeah, and anti-Semitism is very difficult to define, let alone quantify. And so it was important for us to provide an accurate picture that doesn't downplay any threats or incidents, but also doesn't overstate any of those things. So there is an organization called the AMCLA Initiative that tracks anti-Semitism and BDS activity across the United States, and they're very thorough in their tracking. So we wrote, and it's actually linked on the homepage of the College Guide, a very detailed explanation of our methodology, and we explained, you know, which definitions of anti-Semitism we use and which we didn't, because they were, while, you know, unfortunate, sort of on the line where some people could say that they're definitely anti-Semitic and some people could say, well, that's just really harsh criticism of Israel. We count schools that have BDS activity that does hurt them in the scores, but we also schools that have had anti-Semitic incidents as we define them, for example, in physical assaults of Jewish students, in swastikas painted on walls. That was something that we talked about a lot, and we're certainly open to refining it further. But we wanted to make sure that we struck a balance between overplaying and not overplaying nor underplaying the issue of anti-Semitism.
Have you had any complaints?
Have we had complaints? Yeah, we've had a few. I think some of them, as we said before, came from wondering why a school isn't ranked higher.
I mean, we're talking about Jews. What a silly question the rabbi asked. Of course you've had complaints.
Yeah. I think for the most part, we've been pleased in the positive reaction. I mean, we didn't think that everyone was going to love it, but I'm pretty satisfied with how many people said that they found it easy to navigate and provided a lot of useful information all in one place.
Right. And the few, strong critiques that we've had, we've been able to, thankfully, turn them into productive discussions. Like, some people have a very specific qualm with the methodology, and that helps us think about ways to refine it for next year. At the end of the day, this is a public service that we are providing and working on, so we do want to make sure it's as good as it can possibly be. But also just, hearing from people with a lot of opinions that a lot of times have a lot of qualifications for making those opinions. They're educators, they're university professors, they have been in the Jewish community for a long time. Hearing from them really shows that they care about our opinion of these schools and they care about our methodology. So that, to me, is kind of a positive part of that.
You had to omit some schools. Are you planning on adding more into your survey next year?
Definitely.
Yes.
One thing I forgot to mention is that, in addition to all the information that we provide, we also have a directory of scholarships for Jewish students that different universities provide. So obviously college is incredibly expensive and growing more so every year. So if you're Jewish and looking for a scholarship for Jews, you can find it in the Forward College Guide at a lot of universities around the country.
I want to personally thank you for that, adding that, because I have at least two kids who are going to be in higher education at the same time for the foreseeable future. So thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I want to thank Aiden Pink and Laura Adkin for a great visit here on Too Jewish. And I hope it comes out even better next year. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
Are you curious? Well, now we have everything you wanted to know about Judaism, but we're afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's famous Taste of Judaism program, now in its 18th year, offers an exploration of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community, taught by our rabbis. This free introductory class is immensely popular in Southern Arizona. 6,000 students have enjoyed Taste to date, and you can too. Call 327-4501 for more information and register today. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity to learn more about Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. Rediscover your roots or simply satisfy your curiosity about Judaism. Classes are free and open to all, and we feed you too. We have daytime and evening classes in Central and Northwest Tucson, and this year also in Green Valley. Taste of Judaism starts soon, so don't miss it. Again, it's free with no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501 or email temple@tetucson.org. Call 520-327-4501 for a fun way to learn about Judaism.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be songwriter David N. Weiss, who penned The Rugrats, The Smurfs, All Dogs Go to Heaven, and Jimmy Neutron, among others, discussing his journey back to Judaism. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning is Yom Zeli Yisrael, This Day Belongs to Israel. That's Shabbat, Friday night and Saturday, the day of joy and rest, sung by Avremi Roth. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.